Hello, welcome back to the Masonic Roundtable, a weekly program where Masons from around the world get together to talk about Masonic news and opinions in a friendly and social manner. As a reminder, the thoughts and opinions expressed here are solely opinions of the participants and do not represent any Grand Lodge statements or positions. Make sure you keep your conversations open for the public and on the level. To interact with us, as always, you can catch us live every Thursday night on YouTube or on the Facebook. So hello and good evening to all of you cool people who watch us live. If not, that's okay too. You know me. My name is John Ruark. I'm a past master of the Patriot Lodge, number 1957 in Fairfax, Virginia. And next up tonight, we have... Who do we have? Let's start with Jason Richards.
Hey, good evening, everybody. Jason Richards here, past master of Acacia Lodge number 16 in Clifton, Virginia, a member of the Colonial Lodge number 1821 in Washington, D.C.
Excellent, excellent. And from all the way from Manassas Lodge, we have Joe Martinez.
Good evening.
With somebody behind Joe Martinez? Him.
Yes, that's our secretary. Everybody say hi to Carl.
Hey, Carl.
Hi, Carl.
I forgot my name because you didn't put it up. I'm Joe Martinez. I'm a member of Manassas Lodge number 182. Tonight is a Royal Arch night, so that's why I'm so handsome looking. And yeah, super jazzed to be here.
Awesome. Next up, Robert Johnson. Hello, good evening.
Hey, what's up? Robert Johnson, past master Waukegan Lodge number 78, and current sitting secretary at... the most amazing academic / education lodge in Illinois, Space Novum 1183. Good to be with you guys.
Awesome, awesome. And we have a special guest for tonight, and that is Worshipful Brother Chris Rulli. So let's bring you up here, and there you are. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So Chris Rulli, I'm a member of Potomac Lodge number 5 in D.C. and Federal Lodge number 1 in D.C. I'm the Grand Historian and Librarian for the Grand Lodge of D.C. for the Scottish Rite, York Rite bodies, basically anything about history in D.C. I probably am an officer in that position. So thanks for having me.
So you couldn't decide which lodge was truly the oldest lodge in D.C., so you had to join them both.
So what I tell people is I'm from the oldest lodge, both of them.
Which one? Yes. Yes,
I Yes, am. Exactly. You are correct, sir. And then I walk out.
For those of you who aren't in on the joke, that's a rivalry in DC Masonry is between Federal and Potomac on which one is truly the oldest, because one was founded first and the other is the longest continually running lodge, right?
Yeah, it's all dumb for anyone outside of DC. Who cares? Who really cares?
Exactly.
Have you seen how many titles we have in Masonry? There are people who care a whole lot more about a whole lot less.
It sounds
you
like
have
a urinary
not seen
contest.
All my bubbles. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm a Capulet and a Montague for those who enjoy good Shakespeare.
Wow, that's digging deep, and I love it. So, spoken like a true historian.
Thank you.
All right, before we get into tonight's topic, I do want to give a special shout out to the patrons who support the show. If you like Masonic education, you want to keep the show going for a while, head over to patreon.com/themasonicroundtable, where you can go see some behind-the-scenes stuff, go nerd out with us during the week, and all sorts of other goodies. So, hope to see you there. Now, so tonight, speaking all things history, we thought, why not bring the grand archivist and historian on board to really nerd out about many things about DC history, the least of which being relating to what we're smack dab in the middle of is this whole thing about, I don't know, Dan Brown and the Masons and DC. Never heard of it, but we might as well talk about it. And so Chris is going to set us straight. And I know that you had a couple things prepared, but trust me, if you watch David's work over at the Scottish Rite YouTube channel, you'll know that he is just an encyclopedia, a Nick Johnson, Ooh. As it were, of DC Masonic history. So with that, I'm going to hand it off to you to kind of set the stage and jump off on your first anecdote that you want to talk about tonight. Brother Chris.
Sure. Cool. Thanks. Yeah, I guess I'm a poor man's Nick Johnson. How about that? I'll say that. Why don't we, John, if you don't mind putting up the slide there, we can start. So yesterday, for those who are familiar or interested in at least D.C. Freemasonry or D.C. history, you'll know that the cornerstone of the White House was laid yesterday. Was it 229 years ago? 1792 was the cornerstone laying. So when I reached out to John, I was like, hey, why don't we do something on that? And then I realized I also have some comments on lost symbol. So I figured I'd, you know, provide some interesting insights there. So I think what I'm going to do is, rather than go into a full history of the District of Columbia, which will take several hours and no one wants to hear me talk about all that stuff, I figured, why don't I talk a little bit about the White House? You know, it's a prominent building, very prominent in DC Freemasonry as well, based on the number of people that were involved in the construction, in the renovations, as well as just the upkeep and the interesting, you know, events that occurred around it. And we really can't go into the history of DC, or at least the history of the White House, without sort of going to the beginning, which is really great because the District of Columbia, you know, the formation and Freemasonry sort of gets woven into the formation of the district, which is really cool. So in 1790, when the Residence Act established the District of Columbia, it empowered Washington to basically develop and to move all of the federal buildings around, you know, Pennsylvania, New York City to the district by 1800. And so, you know, Washington's a busy guy, president of the United States. He's got a lot of other things to worry about than the minutia of trying to set up the District of Columbia. So he appoints three commissioners, David Stewart, Thomas Johnson, and a guy named Daniel Carroll. And all three are not architects. They were not city planners. It's sort of strange, but they were guys that Washington knew very well and trusted. And so rather than going for technical guys, I think Washington was looking for project managers, more guys that he trusted. Oh, yes. Well, I think one of them was, if my memory serves me right, one of them was a brother-in-law or a family related. So, yes, there's certainly some nepotism there. So they were looking for project managers. I mentioned the commissioners, those three guys that were really focusing on the day-to-day activities. And then, of course, mentioned in the Lost Symbol, mentioned in, you know, the history of D.C., Pierre Charles L'Enfant is a big one, Andrew Ellicott of Ellicott City, Benjamin Banneker, and they are brought on because they need to help, you know, go through and survey and develop the map of D.C. and the city planning and all that. And of course, other people get involved. James Hoban, Irish architect, well, he wins the design competition to, set up and construct the White House. So, the commissioners select his plan compared to a couple others, including Thomas Jefferson, who submits his own proposal. And in addition to helping supervise the White House as the architect of the White House, he also co-supervises or assists as a secondary for the Capitol building. And so, you know, he's got a lot of work there. A guy named Colin Williamson, a Scottish stonemason, is brought on to manage the quarry, right? And so the commissioners and L'Enfant actually secure the Aqua Stone Quarry. And of course, in the show Lost Symbol, there's even in a previous episode more about that. And they hire, well, I guess they don't really hire, they get 25 slaves to help work in the quarries. And so there's a lot of overlap, right? And so I sort of call it a very messy project. It's a very messy group project because there's a lot of infighting. There's a lot of people sort of cross working and cross, you know, trying to figure things out. It's not really laid out. Off to a good start. And that's really one of the issues, right? With the early formation of the district, there wasn't a plan in place before they started. They were doing it off the cuff as they were going through. So in 1790, well, the first plans and the first surveys aren't coming out until the following year. In fact, if you want to go to the next slide, We can, John, if we can do that, you'll see this is a newspaper account of the cornerstone laying for the White House. So this is 2 years after the Residence Act, 1790, so 1792. And so this document, and I jokingly talk about this in other videos, what we do with the Scottish Rite is Masons are great Masons, but terrible record keepers. We didn't even have a record of the cornerstone laying ceremony until later on during the Truman renovations, when a librarian in South Carolina finds this document that you see here. And it's basically what, a couple sentences about the events that occurred October 13th, 1792. And in fact, it's not even a report from the event. It's actually a letter by someone about that event. So it wasn't even like a firsthand account. It was actually someone's, someone went there and they decided, hey, maybe we should publish this. And so you'll see there a couple names that are very prominent and familiar. You'll see at the top there, you'll see that that's actually a copy of the brass plate that gets placed under the cornerstone of the White House, George Washington, the three commissioners, as I mentioned, James Hoban, and then Colin Williamson. Now, Colin Williamson, in addition to being a stonemason, he was also a Freemason. And so in addition to Hoban, of course, and two of the three commissioners were Masons. And so that plaque is pretty stacked with Masons in terms of representation. And then, you know, they start off at Souter's Tavern during that event. Well, Souter's Tavern is actually a very prominent tavern in Georgetown. That is where Washington came to negotiate to get the land for the District of Columbia. That was the place where Thomas Jefferson and John Adams actually went and discussed with the commissioners, okay, what are we going to call this thing? Well, why don't we call it Washington City or the Federal City? And they gave it a couple different names, but that was where they came up with the District of Columbia name. That is where the Masonic Lodge, this is the lodge that we're talking about here, Lodge Number 9 of Georgetown, this is where they met. And John Souter not only was a proprietor of the tavern, well, we think he was likely the tiler of the lodge. And it sort of makes sense because he's in charge of the building. And so he would sort of be in charge of who comes in and out of the lodge meeting. And then when they go back to the meeting, right, so they're done, they lay the cornerstone, they actually travel to the White House space, they lay the cornerstone in Masonic ceremony, and then they return and they have this really nice festive board with, 15 to 16 toasts, and some of the toasts are really cool, into the author of The Rights of Man and Common Sense, the Fair Daughters of America, George Washington, General Wayne, and all these different and interesting people. Now, we know for certain that Washington was not present at this event, but he will be present a year later for the United States Capitol building. And so this likely just was attended certainly by Hoban, and the master of that lodge, Lodge Number 9 of Georgetown, was a guy named Peter Casanova. He was a Spanish merchant. He barely spoke any English, according to the time, and he later becomes the next, mayor of Georgetown after he serves as master. So you go from master to serving as a mayor of a town. That's a pretty interesting lineup.
Yeah, usually past masters try to do the least amount possible. So
that's right. Back in my year.
Yeah.
Back in my year.
Can we keep that down? Can we keep that down? Because there's like 20 of them in this building right now.
Past masters are essential to the operations of the lodge. That's what I meant to say.
Yes. Well, maybe you could use earphones next time.
I didn't know I'd still be here, so don't be sassy. But Brother Chris, I have a question.
Yeah,
sure. Failure to plan is planning to fail.
Ooh.
Hope you're not master next year, Joe.
I'm so
tired. You can still be mayor.
Could be mayor.
Could be mayor. This town. That'd be weird. Brother Chris.
That's right. Yes. Maybe I'll be mayor.
The best lodge in Washington, D.C. meets at Georgetown Masonic Hall. Is that the same place where they met, or did that place come later?
That place came later. We actually don't know where Souter's Tavern is or was. We know it was demolished. We know at one point it was an oyster house. No comment there. But we just don't necessarily know where that location is anymore. And there were several articles by the D. Yeah, of course. Yes, it was in New York. The D.C. Historical Society, there, Oliver Wendell Holmes was this, you know, big Supreme Court justice. He actually wrote a history just on Souter's Tavern and was going through legal, you know, in legal terminology, trying to figure out, okay, where could it be? It could be here. It could be here. Here's what we have. So we really don't know, unfortunately. Now, the lodge that meets in Georgetown, or there's several lodges that meet in Georgetown now, that building was erected in like 1850, 1860. So several decades later. John, do you mind going back to the slides on the next slide, please? Yeah. And so I think one thing that you also got to realize is, okay, there's a lot of people, right? There's a lot of people doing lots of different things, and they sometimes interact and envelop, you know, work with each other. You also have to realize that at this point in the District of Columbia, creeks, forests, hills, it's not inhabited. In fact, Georgetown, as we talked a little bit before, really serves as the main entry point for ships, for construction crews, for all the people that are coming in. And so, you know, it's no wonder that the year before the Residence Act that initiated Georgetown was when the first Georgetown Lodge, or official first town, Georgetown Lodge was erected in Lodge Number 9. And so it was grouped with many, you know, there are many different people from different parts of the country, different parts of the world, different, an eclectic taste that came to Georgetown at this time. And so in 1792 at the White House, what you actually see is the area becomes a mini city on itself, right? And so it takes several hours just to get from Georgetown to the White House. And I jokingly always say it takes several hours even in DC now to get from Georgetown to the White House with, you know, commuter traffic. But DC, you know, the White House area at this point was its own little mini hub. And there's a really great article from the DC Historical Society that was printed in 1913 called The Erection of the White House. And it goes into the logistics of what was it like, you know, back when Hoban and this, you know, Masons were trying to organize this thing. And it goes into housing and really it was more like shanties. I mean, you know, small wooden construction places. You're not talking about stone brick around the time. They were really focused on primarily focused on building the White House. There was parts about food. There was parts about healthcare, right? What happens when someone got hurt during the, you know, there's no OSHA or anything. So what happened, you know, at that time? And so it goes into, well, there were Brother Masons who were actually the doctors who helped, you know, bandage and support the people that were working there. There were Brother Masons that brought in the food. And, you know, and in fact, the first vintner of Virginia, a guy named Andrew Estave, I'm probably butchering his last name, but he was a Frenchman. He contracted with Hoban to bring in food so the folks were, you know, fed properly. There were issues and letters between the commissioners and Hoban and Williamson and everybody around payment and non-payment, and money was actually really difficult to get. You'd think that you're starting this project, they give you money. Well, in fact, the commissioners had to go to Congress on several occasions just to request money. It's like, okay, well, we need some money to complete this. And it's sort of unthinkable now, but, you know, yeah, that was one of the issues that they faced.
Yeah, good thing Congress really turns around budget requests right now, like drop of a dime. So,
of course.
Is that when the debt started?
Is that when it all started?
Yeah.
Did the borrowing from other countries start to build the White House?
Exactly. Exactly. Masons were really the reason why, right? Mm-hmm. So, and obviously right now what we're talking about is unskilled labor, right? We're talking about the folks that were coming in to move, right? They set up this, they identified the Aquia Creek. They were able to bring the stones over. And so one of the things that we're missing about this is the technical, the folks that were actually now coming in to carve, to inlay, to really set up and to do the front and to the foundations and the walls. And so, unfortunately, at this time, there's letters and commentary back and forth by the commissioners that were like, we can't find anyone in the United States. And so they're trying to look for people. And in fact, they get to the point where there's one example of a guy named George Walker, who's a Philadelphia, either Philadelphia or Pennsylvania merchant, who is in London at the time. And the commissioners seek him out and say, hey, listen, if you're there, try to find capable young stonemasons that can come over, that can, you know, do the difficult travel to the United States, to Georgetown, to work on this stuff. And so, in fact, Walker finds about 12 or a dozen or more stonemasons in Edinburgh, Scotland at the time, and convinces them to come, and of course, you know, sets their wages and is able to bring them over to the United States. And in fact, six of them that we know of came from this Lodge of the Journeymen. I think it was either number 8 or number 9, and they were Freemasons. And so again, you're thinking about all of a sudden prominent Masons, as well as operative and speculative stonemasons, are coming to the district. They are forming, you know, a small city around the White House with little shanties areas and a hospital and, you know, places where they're cooking and they're doing these things. And they're basically creating this original energy. And these Masons eventually figure out, well, wait a minute, as part of this environment, why don't we form a, you know, a lodge here? Why don't we have a social as part of our, you know, our work?
Which was common. I mean, when you had traveling Masons, especially in the colonies, around the time period, it's like if they were in the same town, they kind of found each other and started doing lodge work. So that's cool.
Yeah. And you wouldn't be surprised if you look through the letters that they often fought with each other in public spaces and in public spheres, and they disagreed. And, you know, at one point Williamson is fired because Hoban and the commissioners are like, hey man, you didn't build a basement for us. We asked you to build a basement. So I absolutely love when the people talk about the Capitol basement, they don't even realize that there wasn't even a basement because the Mason who was contracted actually didn't do it.
But in the Lost Symbol.
I just love that.
Well, Chris, if you were a member of the Leviathan group, you would know where the basement was, but you're not.
And you know what? The Leviathan group had a different sub, you know, line in their contracts. Right. So, there's this interesting interaction, right? And so this is the sort of energy, that momentum that creates Federal Lodge number 15. It comes from this group of guys that are contracting and working at the Capitol, at the White House. Well, actually, yes, and in the Capitol. And they're, you know, they're creating this space. And that's really where we get the Federal Lodge. Now, that Federal Lodge, the operative Federal Lodge, that I like to call it, dies out maybe a decade afterwards, and then it's brought in by the speculative guys who are coming in and really trying to maintain and support the spirit of that lodge, because these guys are active stonemasons. So they're going to go and travel and go to different places around the country, and some of them likely returned back to Scotland to continue their work and to make their wages. John, why don't you go on to the next slide and we'll talk a little bit about that. So one of the stories that I
also have to mention the time capsule in the Capitol building that may or may not have some Masonic artifacts in it.
I don't know if Chris knows that story. I'm gonna save that for the end.
Ooh, okay, all right, cool. Well, I'm going to tell you a story that I'm 100% sure you don't know. Well, maybe some of you know, and if you do, that's great.
Challenge accepted.
Challenge accepted.
Google.com. Go ahead.
Here we go. Yeah. So during the War of 1812, there were a lot of really good. So at the Library of Congress, we have a lot of good diaries on recounting what happened during the War of 1812. And so the War of 1812 doesn't really hit D.C. until literally, I guess, until August 24th, 1814, when the British invade. They go through the Battle of Bladensburg. So they're actually going north. They're going from Bladensburg, which is at the top, down into the district. And so, you know, the district tries to defend itself during the Battle of Bladensburg, but the British overtake them. And, you know, many Masons supported and were actually fought during that battle. And so we have records of who participated and from which groups, like the Georgetown group and, you know, Georgetown Artillery or the Navy Yard group. And so, you know,
East
Masons
side,
did
the West side.
Yeah. Well, and I think,
Bloods,
you know, honestly, that's
Crips.
Probably, yes. And that's probably the best excuse you can give for not attending a lodge meeting. They're attacking, and I'm just not going to make this tonight, guys. I'm really sorry. Or the alternative. Actually, you know what? I'm just going to stick. Hey, we got like 3 candidates. They're fellow crafts. They've been waiting for a while. Why don't you guys take care of it? Anyway, so the story goes, and if you can go back to that that slide. Thanks. The story goes that when they are done burning the Capitol down, they are marching from the Capitol to the White House. Well, the guy that you see on the right, he eventually becomes a mayor of Georgetown, Roger Hsu Whiteman, is captured by Admiral Cockburn, who's on the left side here. And the story goes that one of the diaries at the Library of Congress say that Whiteman is actually brought into the White House, and at this time Dolly Madison was having dinner, or when she evacuated, they were in the midst of a dinner. And so he put Whiteman down, and they're sitting down, and they're actually toasting. Meanwhile, there are officers around the building. They are torching, they are getting close to torching the building. And they're actually putting in firewood. They're putting in more wood because they really want to make it burn. And Cockburn tells Whiteman, "You can select whatever you want in this building as a memento because I'm about to burn this down." And so Whiteman picks up something of value. Unfortunately, we don't necessarily know what he is, what he picks up. And, you know, Cockburn's like, "Okay, actually, that thing that you picked up is very valuable. In fact, why don't you just find something meaningless because I'm going to burn everything down." And right before he burns something down, he sort of toys with Whiteman, and he goes and takes a hat from the president's hat that was just sitting on, you know, some counter. He takes the hat and the cushion from a pillow or like a seat cushion, and Cockburn takes those as his own mementos and says, "You can take this filthy, you know, stupid piece of paper and watch as I burn this building down." And so they exit, and he burns the building down. And so it's this weird sort of, you know, interesting event that happened. Now, that guy is a past master of Federal Lodge. He eventually becomes a mayor of D.C. And so this is one of the stories of a Mason that was involved in the White House ceremony, or certainly not the ceremony, the White House burning. And that's probably a story you may not know.
One Mason's burning is another Mason ceremony.
That's right. Yeah. In some ways. Yes, absolutely.
That is deep.
Yeah, that's right. Let's go to the next slide, John, if you don't mind. So the next day, Cockburn goes to the offices of the National Intelligencer, which is the newspaper of the day. Think of it as the Washington Post of D.C. at that time. And the paper was run by two men, Gales and Seton, John Gales and William W. Seton. And Seton is the one on the bottom, Gales is the one on the top. And Cockburn goes in because he has a vendetta against these guys, because prior to Cockburn arriving in Washington, these guys are blasting the British in newspapers, calling them terrible and, you know, just saying all these terrible things. Well, apparently, these two guys call him a ruffian. And he is so offended, Cockburn is so offended by the fact that he has been besmirched and been called a ruffian, that he orders his troops to go in to burn the building. Now, right before he does, apparently, according to, you know, eyewitness accounts, ladies, the women who live next door run to Cockburn and say, "Please don't burn this building down because you'll likely burn our houses down." And he goes, "Okay, fine. I'll try to be a gentleman. I will ask my officers to remove this building brick by brick and make sure we go in and remove all the C type letter sets," right? So anything with the C, I will remove, so they never have another opportunity to besmirch my name. Now, W. Seton, of course, is a past Grand Master of D.C. He prints a lot of the paperwork for the Grand Lodge of D.C. And so it's interesting that, you know, he gets involved in this. Gales was not a Mason, but Seton certainly was. And so that's another story of Cockburn's revenge against two different Masons.
Well, didn't when George W. Bush... when he left office, that the staffers took all the W's off the keyboards many years later.
There you go. So yes, there you go. So let's go into the other slide, if you don't mind.
Don't mind at all.
Well, thank y'all. So here are some across the, you know, over time, Masons have either gone to the White House or participated with, you know, presidents in various Masonic activities. And so I've just found a couple photographs that I thought would be interesting for people to see, you know. So, for example, the Supreme Council, right around the time after Andrew Johnson, you know, they all would frequently visit the White House and have an annual, during the biennial, they would meet the presidents. And so oftentimes there'll be photographs with the presidents on the lawn. At the top right, you'll see Howard Taft, of course, in AW-22 attire. And in fact, he's actually holding the George Washington trowel, which was used in 1793 to lay the cornerstone of the Capitol. And at the bottom there, you'll see FDR. He has his Tall Cedars of Lebanon hat. Tall Cedars. There's always a Tall Cedar somewhere. And then, of course, at the bottom right is an interesting story where the District of Columbia was organizing a Masonic fair. They called it the National Masonic Fair and Exposition. And in one of those years, they actually held three. Every two or three years, they held a Masonic fair to raise money to build their beautiful building on 13th Street, which is no longer Masonically held. But one of the parts to it, in order to open the ceremony or open the fair, Teddy Roosevelt said that he will participate. And so what they did was they actually connected like cable wire from the convention center to the White House to the cable room. And so when the Masons wanted him to perform the ceremony, he walked into the cable room and he turned on the switch that sent electricity over to the convention and lit the entire hall with all these, you know, beautiful lanterns and illuminations. And so that was an interesting thing that, you know, the crews light. At the White House set up. Yeah, let there be light. Exactly. And of course, Teddy Roosevelt was a prominent Mason. He became a Mason. He actually became a Mason after he won the seat of vice president. So, you know, certain people say he was a Mason before that, but no, in fact, he actually became Mason after vice president.
Do we know where the George Washington trowel is today?
The trowel, well, from my understanding, the trowel's definitely at AW-22 at the memorial. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, there's a replica that they use for Masonic events now. But I believe that's the original that he's holding in his hand, in addition to one of the Washington aprons. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so this is a picture of the Truman renovations, and I think the Truman renovations were around, I want to say, in 1947, 1948 to 1952, so about 4 to 5 years. They gut the entire thing, and when they gut the entire thing, I mean, you know, you can see in that photo, They're going from top to bottom, clearing it entire out, because there hasn't been an entire renovation throughout, you know, and there have been renovations that have occurred. So, for example, Teddy Roosevelt did a renovation of the Oval Office. But that was very small. This, I mean, they gutted the entire interior. And so during that process, what they discovered, and John, if you can go to the next slide, is these marks. Now, there's a little bit of a controversy, and if you talk to, you know, as I do, I talk to Masons, Masonic historians about this. The controversy is when they identified, so Truman was very active in these renovations. In fact, he would bring reporters and, like, personally go around and show people, hey, we dug this out, we cleaned this out, here's what we're planning. Like, he was very involved in the renovation process. And so what they did was they brought him in to inspect the space, and apparently a construction worker or someone tipped him off and said, hey, listen, you got to check this stuff out because we don't know what this is. And so he goes down and he spots it and he says, oh, of course, these are Masonic marks. Now, he believes they're Masonic marks, but in fact, they are the marks of these men that I've referenced before, these skilled laborers from Europe, from Edinburgh and Scotland. So some of them, yes, were done by Masons who were part of that lodge, while many of them were just stonemasons that, you know, that this is their way of marking their work. And of course, you know, we have a brother here already doing some York Rite degrees tonight in his lodge. And so, you know, if you're familiar with the mark degrees for York Rite or for the Royal Arch, this will be relevant to you, this idea. Now, if you go on to the next slide, John, I think the one that I have here, you'll also see...
This is right
out
of the most excellent stick figure degree.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Yeah.
I see.
You'll also see that they didn't necessarily know which side it was. So here's an article... This is an article that I found a couple years later in the Washington Post, where they find the same markings at the Great Falls. There was actually a bridge that was being built or excavated or renovated, and they found these strange markings. And so you'll notice that it's the same guy, perhaps, likely. Maybe it's not. Maybe one guy was like, okay, I'm going to do mine facing up and you're going to do yours flipped. We don't know. But, you know, here's another symbol. And so, again, it's less about masonry and more about the implementation, the craft, the work that was done in doing it. Now, that said, Truman was a smart man. He obviously was a very prominent Mason, an active Mason. He knew that this would be of interest to Masons. He knew that this would bring up a lot of interest for Grand Lodges. And so what he did was he asked the Grand Lodge of D.C., the commissioner of D.C. at the time. One of the three commissioners was a good friend of his. That guy also happened to be the Grand Master of D.C. at the time, Rena Camilleri. And he asked Rena to, okay, you're going to be the next project manager on this. Go on and cut all these out of the White House, and let's send a stone to each Grand Lodge and to Masonic bodies. So, in fact, they actually cut about 100 stones out of the foundation of the White House, and they put that little plaque at the bottom. Well, they didn't really necessarily know which sides they were. They sort of just made a decision and said, okay, this is the side that it's going to be. And then they put the little plaque at the bottom. And they basically spent the next couple years distributing these stones to every Grand Lodge. You know, the Supreme Council got one, the Grand Encampment got one of Knights Templar. They were transmitted over to different jurisdictions, you know, foreign jurisdictions. And in fact, a couple lucky guys actually got their own stone. So Truman, for example, got his own stone on his birthday. So pretty cool. Yeah.
So I have a question about that. There's a rumor that some of them were either unaccounted for or given kind of under the table. And so have they all been accounted for, or are there some that are still yet to be public?
I'm gonna give you the answer of some of them are not accounted for.
Sounds like a good politically correct answer. Good.
Yeah, I mean,
I wonder. I was just gonna say. So one of the things that I think is fascinating is that the people who do this work, what a benefit, right? Like, you get to touch the history, you do these things, you do the excavations. Yeah. Something that is interesting is, for instance, like when an astronaut back in the day, they would get a little bag that they could keep whatever they wanted in that bag to bring back, because they weren't making tons of money. So they could like put some stuff inside this little bag, right? That was literally off limits. Nobody could even look in the bag to tell them they couldn't bring it. And then they would bring it home and be like, this went to outer space, and they could sell it and make some money.
Yeah,
they could have mementos like this, right? So what's interesting is it's like unaccounted for stuff. Like, they could bring home a friggin' moon rock, essentially, if it fit in this little bag. Nobody would ever know, presumably.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, you know, like, it's under the guise of like an unsaid benefit. Now, you know, I just wonder how much, or what are the chances, you know, guys who did this got a little piece of history that's undocumented, but it's really cool. Yeah. I totally would have stole something.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I would have filled that bag up.
I feel like it's almost 100%.
101%. Yeah.
So it's funny that you say that, because there are records of, this is so silly, there are records of like randomly in Grand Lodge proceedings of different, you know, different states, I'll see someone that's like around this time, oh, someone manufactured a gavel from the wood that was taken from the renovation. Well, how did you get that wood? Who was part of that? You know, and in fact, in my lodge, I actually have a huge block of wood from, and it's unfortunately it's too light to make something from it. But, you know, there was a gavel that was made of that wood. In fact, I think I even have a replica of one of those gavels here. But yeah, I mean, it's this idea of like masons who worked as stonemasons or part of the construction team. They sort of like, well, if you're throwing this away, then I will take it.
Chris probably has half of the contraband in that room over there. So
I cannot tell you.
It's good
to
be king.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
So
there was Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, well, I just want to move things along because I know you had some stuff you wanted to mention about the Lost Symbol going on right now.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, so there are some stuff that I found in the Lost Symbol that I was like, oh, I got to talk about that. I definitely got to talk about this. So here's a good point about the Smithsonian Institution. So D.C. Freemasons helped lay the cornerstone of the Smithsonian on May 1st, 1847. Well, it just so happened that the guy who was in charge, or one of the guys who was in charge of figuring out which stones and which quarries and you know, how to set this thing up and the building design, happened to be one of, you know, Cockburn's enemies, as one of the printers, William Seton. So the same guy at the top right, who pissed off the British, was the guy who helped lay the cornerstone, as well as, you know, figure out how to build this thing. So that thought that was pretty cool. The guy below him is a guy named Benjamin B. French. He was a past Grand Master of D.C. and he was, there it is, past Grand Master of D.C. and he was a commissioner of public buildings. And we're going to talk about that in another slide or two. So if you don't mind going to the next slide. Oh, of course. So the Grand Lodge, after the building was done, right, in 1856, which is kind of weird, it's unfortunate. The cornerstone was laid in 1847. It took them until 1855 to finish the building. And so the following year, the Grand Lodge came back and was like, hey, we want to celebrate. And so they did this big address in the big hall of the Smithsonian to celebrate John the Baptist for, you know, the festive board day. Architect of the Capitol, that's another big part of the TV show. And of course, the Architect of the Capitol, the role of the Architect of the Capitol now is everything you see in green over there. The Architect of the Capitol has basically authority and authorization. He's really in charge of that space. Now, originally, and if you go back, or if you go forward just a little bit, you'll see that picture. Originally, the Architect of the Capitol, that role that we have now, was split into two positions. It was the Architect of the Capitol and the Commissioner of Public Buildings, which is why I mentioned Benjamin B. French in the back, a slide or two. Every time. It's going to be great. Every time I say Benjamin B. French. So the Capitol, you have to realize that up until like 1865, 1867, when the dome of the Capitol was set up or finalized, the Capitol was not complete. And of course, you know, in 1814, the British had a say in the construction of the building and burned it down. So again, there was a lot of time from 1793 to 1865. And so you needed someone in charge of maintaining the Capitol, continuing to improve it, to build mm-hmm. upon it, to add to it. And so that was really the role of the Architect of the Capitol, to oversee that spot. Now, in addition to that, well, there's other buildings on Capitol Hill. And so the Commissioner of Public Buildings, that was his job. It was his job to make sure that the rest of the space was managed, that it was properly manned, that they had, you know, people working on it, and it was clean and organized and all that stuff. And so that role eventually got absorbed into one position that became the Architect of the Capitol. And that occurred because of a guy named Benjamin B. French. Hold for applause. Woo! There we go. Let's move on. Let's go on the next slide. So Benjamin B. French was one of the perhaps the most popular. He was the most popular of the Commissioner of Public Buildings. And so it was through him that we go through and we see that the dome is finally completed. In fact, he was so prominent in Masonic affairs that he was, able to prevent the Grand Master, or as Grand Master, he was able to, you know, usurp the President of the United States' power to stop a cornerstone laying ceremony from happening. This happened around Millard Fillmore's reign as president, or term as president, I should say, not reign, of course, term as president. Fillmore did not want Masons to lay the cornerstone of the extension of the United States Capitol. One of the reasons why is because Fillmore was an anti-Mason. He joined the anti-Masonic movement in New York. And so he said, well, wait a minute. If I've got to bring the Masons in for this, then I've got to bring the Odd Fellows, and I've got to bring all these. Can't we just do the ceremony without this? Can I just lay the cornerstone and we move on from it? And when Benjamin B. French found out, he rallied the troops. And in fact, he found out from the architect of the capital that they weren't doing it. And so he rallied the troops and was able to convince, he lobbied, I guess you should say, is the political term. And he was able to stop Fillmore from going forward with a non-Masonic ceremony. So they did. And in fact, French got Fillmore to participate in the ceremony sort of as a, you know, hey man, at the end of the day, you got to have the Masons do this ceremony. Now, what you're seeing on the right-hand side is a queue of, to me, it's like one of the most remarkable photographs. Of course, it's the Gettysburg Address with Lincoln. And of course, the Gettysburg Address was done so quickly that by the time the photographer finished setting up, Lincoln was done and he was about to finish sitting down. Well, if you see that little arrow there, that's Benjamin B. French, because he served as an assistant marshal during the ceremony. And in fact, he provided the music for the ceremony during the event. So it's really cool that, you know, a commissioner of public buildings, past Grand Master of D.C., participated in the Gettysburg dedication ceremony. So that's just really cool.
I'm sorry, then, of course, Joe didn't go woo the last time you mentioned that name.
So I'm kind of triggered. Yeah, no, I understand that. So he was telling an actually awesome story about Benjamin B. French. So that's why I allowed him to continue without wooing. But Benjamin B. French Lodge, number 15, best lodge in D.C. Continue.
I hear good things.
You just said it two more times without wooing. Do you not woo yourself?
There you go. Okay. Cool.
Be consistent.
And so, as I said before, that job of Commissioner of Public Buildings, Architect of the Capitol, that sort of merges, and later on it sticks to what, and it becomes and evolves into what we see today. And those are two photographs of former architects of the Capitol, Elliot Woods on the left, David Lynn on the right. They are both Masons. Elliot Wood, in fact, helped supervise the construction of the House of the Temple on 16th Street. And David Lynn and both Elliot Woods participated in Masonic ceremonies. Elliot Woods actually chartered a lodge in D.C., helped charter Temple Lodge in Washington, D.C. So he wasn't just, you know, a Mason by name, very active, very engaged. And he was the architect of the Capitol. Pretty cool.
So, Brother Chris, question for you while you're still on the
architect
of the Capitol.
Sure.
Did you, I'm assuming the answer is yes. You read the book at the same time you're watching the show, right? Or you've read the book already?
I've read the book. I read the book I think I read the book like first year I was a Mason. You know, I was like, this is masonry. Cool. It was not.
So thoughts on, and if you've been watching the show, I feel like they're leaving out a lot of the really important DC history bits in the show, you know, and in favor of, hey, we've got an action scene, this, or like the architect of the Capitol is basically, and you'll hear this on the Found Symbol, is basically the getaway guy, and he doesn't really have any more importance. You know, so they don't bring that stuff from the book into the storyline on the show. And it's kind of a bummer because you get to see all these cool places like the secret basement that you don't know about in the Capitol you know, those other types of things. But it's kind of a bummer that they all the little tidbits of DC masonry that are awesome, they're really not touching in the TV show.
Yeah, and by the way, I'm done with the slides, so I'm happy to open up, you know, to discussion or if anyone has questions. But I guess as the job that I run unofficially as the grand historian, it always disappoints me when they don't mention the 30,000 things that I am have the time. I'm like, oh, they missed this. I think at the end of the day, the writers were trying to make a general audience find this interesting. And the fact that, you know, they call it Oaken Hill instead of Oak Hill, it's like they take liberties on certain things.
I'm waiting for the Chris Rulli version. So if you could get to editing that would be awesome.
Honestly, if there was a scene in any show where they had that Mason get brought up into the White House and go pick something, and then later on he's like, okay, by the way, we're burning this entire building, that's just a cool, interesting scene that I'd love to see. But yeah, no one wants to see my edition. It's very boring. Yeah.
Go ahead. Finish it up.
No, I was just going to say, I realize this, like, you know, episode 4 on, where I'm just like, it's not going to be geared towards the super historian guy. But if someone who's not a Mason goes and reads this or sees this and goes, okay, this is interesting, and then wants to learn more and then goes to a lodge and perhaps finds interest in it, then perhaps this is great. But I don't think they're certainly not gearing it towards Masons, I don't think.
All right, so we're at that final part of the show where we go around, and I'm going to save some never-before-heard information for the final thought at the very end, so stick around for that. So let's go over to Jason Richards. What did you like?
Being a history buff, just absolutely love hearing about the Masons who impacted in a very real way the nation's capital. And so, Chris, I appreciate you coming on and sharing all of your knowledge with us, because it's fascinating to break through the myth of, oh, every single founding father ever was a Mason. Like, no, but there were some Masons who did some really cool things and helped shape, literally and figuratively, the founding of the country. And so that's really cool and awesome. And I appreciate you coming on and chatting with us about it.
Yay. All right. How about you, Joe?
So, Brother Chris, fantastic having you on. It really was. You definitely taught me some things I did not know. And I did not know that, your secret favorite love is Benjamin B. French. But that Ooh. Definitely puts you up
Sorry.
Some notches in my book. Brother. So, this is fantastic. And, I look forward to discussing with you again when you come to Benjamin B. French Lodge. Thanks.
Woo. Robert.
Woo.
Where to start? Just an amazing history. And as Jason pointed out, these guys are amazing and influential doers, movers, and shakers. It's not that there's all these Masons. It's that these movers and shakers happen to be Masons. Guys who get who feel the call, right? So it's almost as if, yes, I mean, everybody's got some skeletons in their closet or whatever you want to say. But on the whole, these are guys who are movers and shakers that were, just prolific iconoclasts, the guys who got things done, guys who had power and influence and used it, arguably, pretty responsibly to build, everything that we, or has left their indelible mark on a lot of enjoy today. So I really enjoyed the look at some of this. I will say Benjamin B. French at the risk of Joe wooing. Loved that lodge. It was awesome to go out there. Amazing history, very eclectic group of individuals, very cosmopolitan, very, I don't know, it's just very Washington, D.C. feeling. Yeah, it is awesome. So really cool. If anybody's interested, it's a pretty cool book out. It's this Solomon's Builders, which was a pretty cool book that Hodapp did. It's did the Freemasons create the United States of America on the back, right? It's kind of made as a guide to go along with Dan Brown's Lost Symbol, but a cool book nonetheless. I think I would recommend that to people who are interested in some of the, Masonic stuff around D.C. I can't remember where I got this. Maybe, I don't know. I have a feeling maybe like John or Jason sent it to me. I can't remember, but anyway, cool stuff. Chris, thanks for coming on and telling us all those, amazing history. And we're all smarter now, and now we can go back and have a much better broad range of did you knows other than, George Washington, right? Like, George Washington, let me tell you about this. So very cool. Thanks so much. I just wanted to, at the last second here, we just got the links for it. If you're a Mason in the Chicagoland area, we just got done planning it. I contacted all the speakers, like basically anybody who's anybody is going to be there. It's called the Double Eagle Con. Okay, so if you go to tinyurl.com/DoubleEagleCon2021, you'll see a full list of speakers and stuff. It's going to be this December. So short on time. Tickets are on sale now. $90, all-day event. But if you wait till too late, it's going to go up to $120. So get your ticket now And I hope you guys enjoy, and we'll see you there. Chris, thank you so much for coming on.
Is that it, RJ?
Yes, sir. Yeah, Saturday, right. December 18th.
Be there and be square.
be double-headed.
All right, Brother Ruli, again, thank you for your wealth of information that you always bring to the show. You're always welcome back anytime. And, man, I just love nerding out with you because you can tell when someone's passionate about the material and they know the material, right? So there's a good combination there that you have to be, you know, you know the material, but you could be very boring and you're not. So thank you for that. And you're passionate about it. And that energy drives into some really great conversations, some great presentations. And I know everyone, just the chats are blowing up about how awesome this was. So again, I want to thank you very much for your time tonight.
Sure. Well, thanks again, and I really appreciate it. Just the last, if I may, just 1 minute, not even less than that, just to let people know that I've been compiling a series of, meetings, interactions, newspaper clippings, all this stuff. And so I'm writing a book on every single time a Mason has met the President of the United States in Washington, D.C., all the dinners, the cornerstone ceremonies, the parades, all that stuff. And so that book is currently being written. And I look forward to it being published, and I hope you all can enjoy it and read up more about this kind of stuff that I like to talk about. So thank you.
All right. So now I have for you a fun piece of history that you may not know, and you can put this away.
Am I going to add it to the book?
Maybe. So it's not confirmed, okay. But it is third hand information. Got this from a guy in my lodge. My mother lodge is Herndon Lodge number 264 out of Herndon, Virginia. And at one point in time, one of our masters worked for, you guessed it, the architect of the Capitol.
Ooh.
And this point in time also happened to be, in the early 90s when they brought down the Statue of Freedom from the top of the Capitol building for restoration. So the Statue of Freedom was removed from the dome for about 5 months in 1993, at which period of time our master of the lodge decided to place a Herndon Lodge number 264 trestle board at the feet of Freedom before it was placed back on top. Despite being warned not to, you can't keep a good Mason down.
Yes.
And so the mythology is that to this day, there is a Herndon Lodge number 264 trestle board at right under the feet as a capsule under the feet of Freedom on the Capitol building. So the only way we can find out is if we go look underneath. I'll never know in my lifetime, but I hope it's true. I want to believe it's true. This is third hand information. Unfortunately, that master was expelled from Freemasonry a couple of years later for some naughty things. But the story is still a good one, and I hope you guys carry that forward. That's pretty much the whole story as I know it, but certainly feel free to reach out and I can probably find a little bit more information as well.
Cool.
But yeah, so thank you very much from the bottom of my heart. Great presentation, and we'll see you at another future episode because I know you have many, many stories to tell. Stick around for the next in the next 15 minutes, 10:45 Eastern. We go right over to our episode-by-episode breakdown of the Lost Symbol. So we'll cover tonight's episode. So stick around, and we'll see you in a few. And with that, I want to thank you all very much for watching, and keep searching for more light. Have a good night.
Wow.